During the break, Stephanie raised a very interesting question. And the question is, okay, Tony, you're describing these ethnic entities that exist in the city and the way in which they perpetuate ethnic cultures. Is this a good thing? Does this defy the great American melting pot expectation? Shouldn't we as Christians want everybody to become one? And do we, in fact, enhance racism and divisions between people by accentuating ethnic differentiations? That becomes a very serious question. Namely, here's the question raised by Eric Fromm, interestingly enough. So you're not the only one to raise it. Eric Fromm raises the question. Does equality mean sameness? That's a good question. Does equality mean sameness? Do we have equality until we are all the same? And there are those who argue on both sides of the question. There are those who say the thing that we must do is not so much strive for sameness as we must facilitate respect. And we need to learn to appreciate other groups. This is why, for instance, there's Black History Week or Black History Month. Namely, it's not that Black people need to learn these things, but they're really anxious that what? That white people learn about the accomplishments of Black people, that white people learn what Black culture is all about. There is in the world what sociologists call third generation nativism. There's an interesting term, third generation nativism. It's an interesting concept. People come over from a foreign country, let's say from Poland. There's a whole host of studies in the University of Chicago. Thomas and Zenyetki wrote this classical work, The Polish Peasant in Poland and in America. Do you see? What happens to people when they come to this country? Incidentally, his methodology was brilliant. It's the only study that's ever been done this way. What he was able to do was collect thousands of letters that were written by the Polish people who were living in Chicago to their relatives back in Poland, and vice versa. Letters that were written from the Polish people back in the homeland to the immigrants in America, so that they could kind of, and in those letters you can get a feel of how these people are perceiving the social changes. You know, I really love this kind of sociology. I hate this empirical stuff where you're always counting stuff. Wouldn't it be more interesting to read through letters that Polish people were writing to each other back and forth across the ocean and find out what they were really feeling and what they were really thinking and get their honest expressions of how they feel about America and what they like and what they don't like and what's good and what's bad. But the first generation comes and they reestablish their lifestyle from the old country. That's what I was driving at with the Italian market, the Italian culture. It's all reestablished. The second generation tends to rebel against this and tends to become a group that wants to become Americanized. Very often, they will make fun of their parents and grandparents' culture. Matter of fact, there's one Korean comedian that's in big time right now that, you know, jokingly talks about how she was raised and what her Korean mother expected of her. And Italians do this as well. We talk about, you know, how we were raised, how different we are. The second generation tries to get, quote unquote, Americanized. Very often, the second generation will even change its names. They will Americanize their names. My father wanted to change the family name to Campbell. Do you see? To get us into the American culture. This whole tendency, you know that a lot of Jewish people, for instance, have changed their names. A lot of Polish people have changed their names to Americanize them. That's the second generation. The third generation goes two ways. One part of the third generation does become totally Americanized and may, in fact, change their names. The other group tends to revert back. So the third generation Italian not only accepts Italian culture, but becomes more Italian than their parents. They want to speak Italian, they want to live in an Italian neighborhood, They are into their Italian way of life. What we see in the African American community right now is a very delayed form of third generation nativism. All of a sudden, black people don't want to be white Americans. There was a time when they all wanted to be white Americans. If you read the autobiography of Malcolm X, you will realize how much he wanted to be white as he was a boy. Have you read that, Rizzo? I mean, they bought these salves that would lighten their skins. They would get these hot irons and straighten their hair. They still do. There are some people who still do, who want to wear blonde wigs. I mean, they want to be white. They want to assimilate. That's one group. The other group says, hey, man, black is beautiful. Was that an interesting line? Black is beautiful. We are proud of who we are. We are proud of our identity. We want to affirm our identity. And they become more black than ever. And all of a sudden, we begin to see certain things emerge. Kwanzaa. All of a sudden, we say, we don't like the white people's Christmas. We'll go ahead with buying the presents and all, but we want a celebration at this time of the year that will really accentuate what it means to be black. So you have the whole Kwanzaa celebration. You have this rebirth of ethnic identity, and you're finding this extremely intense in the inner city places. Question, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? Does this encourage conflict, hate? How do we handle this? It's happening. What Stephanie wants to know is it a good thing that it's happening? Is this a bad thing that it's happening? Is it a good thing that we have natural zones? Is it a bad thing that we have natural zones? That's a good question. Should we be really trying to figure out how to destroy these neighborhoods? Now, at this point, let me take you to one little study. Not little study, it's a classic study, by Herbert Gans, called The Urban Villagers. What happened is that in Boston, there was a group of people in the city council who said, in fact, we want to redevelop this neighborhood. Remember the great redevelopment programs? As a matter of fact, they were going to facilitate integration. We're going to tear down these old neighborhoods. We're going to build new government housing, and we're going to make sure that there's a good racial mix in these neighborhoods. The best place being in Columbia, Maryland, where they tried to do this and did it fairly well, I think. But this was what they were going to do, urban development. Stokely Carmichael, as I said the other day, said, this is not urban redevelopment. This is urban removal. You're moving people out and moving other people in. We're against it. And they were really opposed to it. What happened in Boston was very interesting. There was this slum area. It was an Italian slum area. And the question is, should we obliterate this slum? I mean, doesn't every city government want to obliterate slums? It's a slum area. So what they did was they hired some scholars to go in and study the whole community and figure out what should be done and how it should be done. And Herbert Gans was one of the guys that was hired to do this. He lived in the Italian community, studied it in depth. Not only did he not advocate obliterating the community in order to facilitate greater integration of Italians into the general population of Boston, he ended up being the primary organizer of the protest movements against the city government that hired him that wanted to destroy this neighborhood. And he asked us several questions. What connotates a slum? Now, this is real cultural differentiation. What makes an area a slum? Well, the answer is the housing, for instance. Hardly any of these houses have central heating. They all have little potbelly stoves in each of the rooms. Nobody has central heating. It's dangerous. And it is dangerous to have these little stoves in various rooms. But then when he got into the Italian community thought that central heating was stupid. Why do you heat the whole house? I mean, if you're going to sit in the kitchen, which is where you sit and visit in the Italian community, you heat the kitchen. You don't heat the whole house. If you heat the whole house, guess what's going to happen? Hot air does what? Rises. So if you get it feeling good on the first floor, when it's time to go to bed, you go upstairs, and what is it? It's stuffy. So what do you white people do? What do you do when it's stuffy? You open the windows and you let all the warm air out. This is stupid. You're spending all of this money to create warm air, and the minute you create it, you blow it out the window. It's a waste. It's stupid. It's costing you a fortune. You people are nuts. If you're going to be in the kitchen, you heat the kitchen. If you're going to be upstairs, you open the windows. You don't want to heat the whole house. He said, you know, this is not bad. What's more is, he found that there were a whole network of intense family connections. Intense family connections. You have to understand what it's like to be Italian in Boston. Sunday always takes the same form. Namely, the family gets together at the matriarch's house. You all go to your mother's house. You know, Pittsburgh's the same way. You can't get people to move out of Pittsburgh. The steel industry closes down. There's no jobs. It's chaos. If ever a city should have lost its population, it should have been Pittsburgh. They stayed. Why? Hey, how can I leave? My aunts, my uncles, my cousins, we're all here together. I'm not leaving, man. If I can't find a job, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm not leaving. You say, but we've got wonderful textile jobs down in North Carolina. Who do I know in North Carolina? These are my people, do you see? And Sunday afternoon, I can remember, you sit around the table. 20 people sit around. In my house, in my mother's house, I should say my mother's house, it was simple. You didn't eat in the dining room. Why? Because nobody fit in the dining room. You couldn't fit all these people in the dining room. You did it in the basement. You had this long table in the basement. And the whole clan got together in the basement. There were all kinds of jokes. Why is the suicide rate among Italians so low? It's hard to jump out of basement windows. Because, you know, there we are. We're in the basement. We used to joke about this, you know. And there we were in the basement. And there was this wonderful thing. We'd sit around, intergenerational. Grandparents, parents, cousins, aunts, uncles, we're all sitting around. And what did you do? You ate the meal, but you didn't just eat the meal. You stayed there the whole day. And what did you do? And I was a kid, I would sit around and love it because all they would do is tell stories. And the stories, of course, would get embroidered. And they'd become more and more wonderful as they, you didn't mind hearing them the second time because they weren't the same. By the time the story gets the third time around, the fourth time around, the fifth time, and you tell the same stories over and over again. Many of us do not understand the role of storytelling. Cultures are dying because we don't know how to tell stories. I mean, please understand that earlier cultures were built around stories. Mary anoints Jesus' head. Do you remember this great scene? And Judas and the other disciples start complaining about this because the money could have been used to take care of poor people. And he says, don't say this. This is a beautiful thing she's done. And listen to this. And whenever the story is told, whenever the story of the gospel is told, this will be part of the story. You know, something was added to the story. My wife marries into the family. She's Scottish-Irish. She gets together and she hears these stories. And of course, they're fascinating. And I knew when she was completely accepted, when somebody said, do you remember the time that Peggy, suddenly her story had become part of the family story? Jesus was saying, the story of Mary, putting the ointment on my head, this is going to be the part of the story of Christianity. Her story becomes part of the larger story. In a sense, you can basically define a familial unit as a group of people who have a shared story. Now, the question is, what happens when a group of people no longer have a shared story? When a family no longer has a shared story? The sociologists would say the family disintegrates. It's the story that held them together. You can't complain about family discrimination on disintegration on the one hand, and at the other hand, call for the end of this ethnic phenomena of gathering together and sitting around the table and talking to each other and telling stories, story after story after story. What does it mean to be a Campolo? You don't understand. With the Italians, the family is this whole group, this whole clan, this whole group. Do you know how the mafia got started under Al Capone? You got to read the biography of Al Capone. That's a fascinating story. That's a fascinating story. Al Capone had this little bootleg thing going. But he had a cousin that didn't have a job. And at the family dinner, they would have this cousin come. And he saw, and the mother says to Al, "Al, can't you get Pasquale a job? I mean, you got this little thing. Can't you get him? I'll take care of him all." But this was a pretty good size extended family. Incidentally, mafia usually calls itself the family. You keep on another brother, another cousin, an aunt, an uncle. Next thing you know, and the poor Al Capone, he didn't have enough jobs for everybody. It was the Depression. So the thing is, if you don't have enough jobs for the little group you got here, what do? You expand your operation. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger until it controlled half of Chicago. And they began to say, we've got to facilitate the exporting of whiskey from Canada, because that's where it was coming from. And they figured out that Moose Jaw, ever hear of Moose Jaw? Every mafia member knew of Moose Jaw, because that's where the trucks came from, across the border. You see up there in Montana, who was guarding the border? You know, we're so concerned about the Mexican border. What about the Montana border? You know, nobody cares about whether or not they come in from Canada. We just care whether they come in from Mexico, right? As a matter of fact, may I point out, the only terrorists that we caught coming across borders were coming across, guess what border? Canadian border. But we're not worried about that border. Which raises some very serious questions. I mean, if you were a terrorist, which border would you try to cross? Let's be honest. But this whole system expanded. Now, here's the funniest story of all. The funniest story of all. Al Capone was the foremost bootlegger in Chicago. Incidentally, you talk about gangs are violent. What did they do? I mean, you know that there was this struggle as to who was going to control Chicago. And ultimately, they took care of the people in the other gang, the Valentine Massacre. They lined them up against the wall, and they shot them all. We took care of these Irish guys. It's over now. Incidentally, the movie The Godfather does a brilliant job of communicating how this whole system works, this extended family. It's a family. It's a family. Mafia guys, the top mafia guys, are multimillionaires. And where do they live? In South Philadelphia. South Philadelphia. Why are you living in South Philadelphia? Because this is where the family lives. You say, but you got so much money, your little row house. You only think it's a row house. What they have done is they bought 5 houses in a row. And it looks like a row house. But if you were to go inside, you would find that the walls are knocked down. And they've got this huge mansion hidden behind this facade of row houses. I mean, it's a strange, but because they don't want to leave South Philadelphia. When Frank Rizzo was running for mayor, he said, you couldn't find anybody in the Italian neighborhood that didn't vote for me. You couldn't find anybody. It's the way it is. He drove me nuts. There's a little book that my students at the University of Pennsylvania in a graduate class published called Sayings of Chairman Rizzo when he was mayor of Philadelphia. Racist comments like you've never heard before, and just matter-of-factly given. When they accused him of being a racist, he says, racist? I'm not a racist. When I was commissioner of Philadelphia, police commissioner, I had more blacks on the police force than any other commissioner in America. And then that's fine. And then he added, and some of them were very decent people. God, I don't believe he said that. Oh, when the school system of Philadelphia was on strike, they said, do you think the school teachers of Philadelphia are overpaid? Answer, yeah, they're overpaid. I went through the school system of Philadelphia, and I didn't learn anything. You didn't say that. I don't believe you said that. They asked him, what do you think the solution to the gang problem of Philadelphia is? And he reached back and picked up a baseball bat, and he says, to give every mother in Philadelphia one of these. Whoa. This is the mayor. This is nuts. I mean, this is the guy that's running the city. I mean, it was nuts. But the family, the whole concept of the family. I don't know how many of you saw that movie Moonstruck. Do you remember this movie Moonstruck with, what was her name?
Cher.
Cher was the, and it was all in the Italian community, and it picked up Italian culture and the music and all. But do you remember the last scene? There's been adultery, there's been unfaithfulness, people have betrayed each other. The last scene is what? Only Italians would understand this. That the old father holds up his glass of Anisette and yells, "Family!" And everybody around the table yells, "Family!" And that's the end of the movie. And only Italians would understand that. This deep commitment to each other, to help each other, to sustain each other. I grew up in one house. I then came teaching at Eastern College, and they let me move out here. Because I really wasn't in an Italian community anyway. But I lived my whole life within one neck of the woods. Please understand, I grew up in West Philadelphia. I went to Eastern College. I went to Eastern Baptist Theological Seminary, City Line in Overbrook. I went to the University of Pennsylvania. I went to Temple for my PhD. What's going on here? It's all what? In one city. You go to teach. Where do you teach? Eastern Penn. Couldn't you get a job anywhere else? My family would kill me if I moved away. My son, on the other hand, feels perfectly legitimate moving to Cincinnati, taking the grandchildren. I mean, and if you ask him, you'll find out how he had to do it. He waited until Peggy and I were in Europe. I kid you not. Left a note on the kitchen table. "We have moved to Cincinnati." No warning whatsoever. It was mind-boggling. And not only did he take himself there, he took his wife, who was my secretary, took the grandchildren, all moved out, and I didn't know they were moving. Came home, and there's a note. "We moved." Why? Because if he had dared tell me he was moving, I would have had the whole clan descend on him. Aunt Rose, you know Aunt Rose, and Anne, my uncles, my cousins, they would descend on him. "You cannot move. You're part of the family. Family, that's it." Now, this is very ethnic. Do you want to destroy this? We had a Chinese student come here during the early days of this graduate program in the first class, when there was still no relationships between China and the United States. It was really bad 25 years ago. Got this one guy to come out of China to come over to the United States. We had to give him a full ride at the school on tuition, but we couldn't pay for his room and board. He never had a problem because the Chinese society is so familial oriented that relatives that lived in Philadelphia in Chinatown put up the money for him to complete his education. They never had met this guy. They've been over here for two or three generations, but they still were connected family-wise. They are still Chinese. I remember when I was teaching at Penn, you had all these secular humanists in the class. Yom Kippur would come, and the Jewish kids would say, "We're not going to be in class next week. It's Yom Kippur. It's the Jewish religious holiday." I'd say, "You told me you didn't believe in God." And they would say, "We may not believe in God, but we're still Jewish." Whew. And you won't understand Judaism unless you understand family life. Namely, was it a bad thing that the Jews did not assimilate? It's a good question. They lost their homeland in 70 AD. They were scattered across the face of the earth. They never disappeared. They never disappeared for one reason: rituals. If you didn't get that, go to see Fiddler on the Roof. Do you remember the opening song? Tradition, tradition. We have our traditions on everything. How to dress, how to act, how to speak. We have roles prescribed. This is what the mother, remember the opening song? The mother has her role and she sings. The mother and she tells what she does. And the rabbi, all the way down the line, they go down. Everybody has his role. Note, everybody has the same role, has their role prescribed within this subculture. Do you see? And when it's time for this community to be destroyed by the communist, The closing song breaks your heart. Anatethka, Anatethka. What's Anatethka? A few sticks, broken down houses. People who come through don't even know they've been there. Anatethka, Anatethka. And the last line is, my home. Whoa, it's all gone now. They destroyed us. They sent us all over the place. We're not together anymore. And the traditions are gone. And the whole story of the musical is how the traditions break down. These traditions, these rituals that held the group together. Emil Durkheim, you ought to know that name. Emil Durkheim, in his book, The Elementary Forms of the Religious Life, and he isn't anything but religious, points out that religious rituals are what hold people together, do you see? They are these things. They create oneness. They create oneness. Now, over and against this is another phenomenon. The Azusa Street prayer meeting. Group of people meet for a prayer meeting on Bray Street in Los Angeles. And they pray for an outpouring of the Spirit. Just a handful of people in the living room. And it happens. And other people started coming to this prayer meeting, speaking in tongues, and all kinds of wonderful things are happening. They grow, so they have to move to this little closed-up wooden shack on Azusa Street. This grows to now 600 million Pentecostals in the world. The earliest evidence of Pentecostalism was not speaking in tongues. Harvey Cox makes this very clear in his book, Fire from Heaven. This Harvard scholar who analyzes the Pentecostal movement. The first evidence that the Holy Spirit has come upon the church, which would pick up something that Stephanie was dealing with during the break, when the Holy Spirit came upon the church, all ethnic differentiations disappeared. The thing that made the Azusa Street prayer meeting such an interesting phenomenon to be observed by the Los Angeles newspapers was not that these people were speaking in tongues, but here were Asians and black people and white people and Hispanic people, and they were all together and they were hugging each other. And the guy that was preaching was an African-American preacher by the name of Seymour. It was this incredible unity of people under the impact of the Holy Spirit. And the day of Pentecost in the Bible is what? That all these people that come from what? All the nations of the earth, all of a sudden under the influence of the Holy Spirit, become one. So we can accentuate, on the one hand, all the positive things about ethnic revitalization, i.e. called third generation nativism. Or we can say, but when the Holy Spirit really comes upon people, does it not bring them together and make them one? Which now raises the question that Eric Fromm raises. Does oneness require sameness? Can we be one in the Spirit and not become like each other? Does equality require sameness? The feminist movement, of course, has had to deal with this. The question was, were women equal to men in the American society? The answer was obvious, no, they weren't. So how do we solve the problem? And for a long time, the feminist movement, as initiated by Betty Friedan, was to try to get women to be what? Men. Like men. Later on, she wrote a second book, as she looked back on it and said, this was not the answer. That women were becoming people who were very uncomfortable in this new skin that they were putting on. You can be assertive without being masculine. There is a feminine kind of assertiveness. And we've got to ask, what does it mean to be assertive? What does it mean to be equal? What is it, and still be women? Do we have to lose what we were in order to achieve equality? So the argument goes on. And I don't know that there's an easy answer to this one, Stephanie, to tell the truth. And I think when you raise the question, there's no easy answer. She raised the question in terms of 9th Street. I said it was a problem. The problem is that the Asians and the African Americans were now working the stands. A problem for whom? It's not a problem for the Asians and the African Americans, is it? It's a problem for whom? The Italians. And for a very good reason. The Asians worked harder. And they did another thing. They had a different view of children. Asians have a tendency when they open up a store for their kids to come and work. If you go to a Chinese restaurant, it's the daughters and the sons that are working along with the father. They don't hire people from the outside. And all of a sudden, these Asian people were working harder, making more money. They were able to sell the products at a lower price because they were making money simply by the effectiveness of their sales. And the African Americans were the same way. They were coming in and they were putting Italian hucksters out of business. So you got these problems. It's a problem for the Italian community. It's not a problem if, in fact, you're saying we all want to become one people. So there's the great question. The American melting pot. What happened, and I'm going to give you another book now. I keep giving you names and books. Is there was a book written by Will Herberg, WHIHERBERG. Will Herberg. I think it's the classic. The name of the book is Protestant Catholic Jew. Now, in understanding urbanization and suburbanization, you have to understand the following. Here's what happens. People in the city start moving to the suburbs. We began to deal with some of the reasons for that. They start moving to the suburbs. However, the suburbs are not really developed along ethnic lines. If you go to a housing development in King of Prussia, it might be all white, but the diversity among the people, you got Polish people, Irish people, Italian people, Scottish people, English, all kinds of people. They do not tend to move into ethnic communities. They tend to move with irrespective of racial, of ethnic backgrounds. But he discovered something. That suburban communities are not organized ethnically. They are organized religiously. That there is a suburb that is Protestant. There will be another suburb that is Catholic. There's another suburb that's Jewish. This is what happened during the 50s, which, since we are very church-oriented and faith-oriented, which leaves us with the following reality. As people were moving to the suburbs in the 50s and identifying themselves religiously, and they were. In the old days, if you went to a party and you said, "What are you?" the answer would have been, "I'm an Italian, I'm Irish." During the 50s and 60s, and even in the 70s, and to some degree to these days, when you were asked, "What are you?" people tended to answer, this is what Will Herberg is, in religious terms, "I'm a Catholic, I'm a Protestant, I'm a Jew." Religious identity became the basis for identity. Got it? Consequently, religious institutions flourished. If you were Presbyterian in the 50s, people were flocking into the churches. If you were Episcopalian, people flocked into the churches. Mainline denominations had a heyday. If you belong to a mainline denomination, and how many of you do belong to a mainline church? What church?
Nazarene.
Catholic. You're not exactly Nazarene. Nazarenes are a special group. They're lower socioeconomic group. I just thought I'd break that to you.
I know that.
Yeah, I just thought I'd. Do you know where they got their name?
Minister to the poor.
That's right. And when they started also in California, here's what happened. This was a church that began to minister to the lower levels of society. And you remember the line from the New Testament, "Can any good come out of
Nazareth?"
We're ministering to the people. Can any good come out of these people? And so they adopted the title, the Church of the Nazarene. We are the Church of the Nazarene. We take the people who are at the bottom. That's where this thing started. They've become slightly upper mobile over the last few years, especially when you got guys like Bill Gaither, you know, in the homecoming thing, spreading all this gospel music, and all of a sudden, Nazarene's becoming respectable. It's a shame. Be this as it may, and I'll tell you why, because lower socioeconomic group people are the most intensely Christian. That's not sociology. That's the first chapter of Corinthians. Has God not chosen those who the world calls nobodies, nothings, and through them revealed his will and his love in the world? I mean, so no, don't get uppity if you think you're in an upper class church, because they're the churches that are the least spiritual. Spirituality tends to increase as you go down the socioeconomic scale. I hate to tell you that. That's a little fact that you should know sociologically. As you move up the socioeconomic scale, you become less and less spiritual. Nobody other than John Wesley understood this one. Because in his journals, he writes these things. When people get saved, they stop boozing it up at the pubs. They're not his words. They stop gambling. They stop going to houses of prostitution. They become decent people who work hard and bring their money home to their families. Working hard, being diligent. It's only a matter of time that they become wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. And as they move up in wealth, they tend to drift away from God. So what shall we do? He asked. This I do know is his quote. So what shall we do? Shall we tell them not to work hard? Not to be responsible with their money? No. This is what we should tell them. It is the responsibility, quote, of every man to work as hard as he can, to make as much money as he can, to spend as little as he can, so he can give away all that he can. That was early Methodism. It's not what it is today. What denomination are you from?
My family's Catholic.
Catholic, okay. That's a mainline group. Very mainline group. Mainline denominations have had their heyday in the 50s. The Catholic Church had its heyday in the 50s. Because people got their identity from their religious affiliation, and you can see how this would bring people into churches. Obviously, that's no longer the case. Now, when people get together at cocktail parties, they don't talk about their ethnic identity. They don't talk about their religion. They talk about their vocation. As a matter of fact, when you get together at a party, there are two questions that are asked. Women ask one question, men ask another question. Out here on the main line especially, it breaks down nicely. What question do the men ask of each other? What do you do? You want to upset people at a cocktail party in the suburbs, and you have to put up with this. Refuse to talk about it. You say, oh, I'd rather not talk about it. And go on to something else. They won't let you off the hook. Because until you tell them what you do, they don't know who you are. Your identity is wrapped up with your vocation. It's vocational identity now. Do you follow it? It's vocational identity now. Will communities emerge in accord with vocation? I don't know. I'm seeing some semblance of it. My son-in-law and my daughter live in Brookline, Massachusetts, which is about 5 miles from Harvard, less than that. And my daughter goes to school, and every kid in the class has parents who are related to Harvard. Either they're teaching in Harvard, or their parents are here doing postgraduate work at Harvard. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, and the kids, you know, they're all these children of brilliant kids, brilliant fat parents, and they've been raised on books. Raised on books. That's part of their culture. Is this become a vocational community? Is it a Harvard subculture? University of Pennsylvania has a very interesting situation. In the area around Pennsylvania, we now have a city within a city. We call it what? University City. We call it that. There's no question about it. What the city found, what the university found out was what? That it was dangerous for their students to go into private housing in the area. If you, you know, a group of students would rent a house in West Philadelphia and live in it, and they'd get mugged, even killed. After several murders, they realized that this was bad for admissions. If you send your kid to Philadelphia, they'll get killed. So they had to do something about it. Oh, they could increase the police and all of that, but to tell the parents, don't worry about your kids, we've got a lot of police on the streets. Wow, that really makes me feel great. Yeah, we got a lot of cops out there, gee. As a matter of fact, this place is infected. What the University of Pennsylvania started doing was buying up the houses. And they've got the money to do it. And they would give their faculty members really great deals if they would buy one of these houses. You bought the house for $50,000, you could sell it. We improve the house, and we'll sell it to you, professor, for $25,000. You're a faculty member. You're moving into the neighborhood. This whole community is changing. It's becoming upwardly mobile. The black people are being pushed out. because the university is buying up these houses. Great conflict between the university and the African-American community while all of this is taking place. But they did create a safe neighborhood in this. It's now become a natural zone that's totally an academic community. I don't know. Maybe there will be others. Certainly there are certain situations like certain places in Tennessee where all the people are related to nuclear science and nuclear energy. So you get these vocational communities. But identity is a big thing. But the suburbs, to a large degree, still are reflections of the 50s and 60s. They still tend to be defined religiously. When I worked for the Presbytery of New Jersey, the Synod of New Jersey, I was doing sociological studies for them when I was just a kid. They sent me in to do survey work, to go door to door, find out who people were. We wanted to start a church in South Amboy, New Jersey, because there were, I think, something like 7,000 new houses there. I went door to door, 7,000. I think I found 25 Protestant families. Everybody else was Catholic. They said, do you want to start a Presbyterian church here? I said, not only don't you want to start a Presbyterian church here, but the few families that I found that were Protestant weren't even Presbyterian. They were Nazarene and Assemblies of God. Your people. Put up one of those churches and you make a go of it. Now, let me just tell you this. Each one of you in this class has a label. The label is Christian. The Apostle Paul says, walk worthy of the name wherewith you're called. You now have a new label. It's time for you to start living up to it.